E. Junto presents The Autobiography of Benjamin Franklin. Introductory note. Benjamin Franklin was born in Milk Street, Boston, on January 6, 1706. His father, Josiah Franklin, was a tallow chandler who married twice, and of his 17 children, Benjamin was the youngest son. His schooling ended at 10, and at 12 he was bound apprentice to his brother James, a printer who published the New England Courant. To this journal he became a contributor, and later was for a time its nominal editor. But the brothers quarreled, and Benjamin ran away, going first to New York and thence to Philadelphia, where he arrived in October 1723. He soon obtained work as a printer, but after a few months he was induced by Governor Keith to go to London, where, finding Keith's promises empty, he again worked as a compositor till he was brought back to Philadelphia by a merchant named Denman, who gave him a position in his business. On Denman's death, he returned to his former trade and shortly set up a printing house of his own, from which he published the Pennsylvania Gazette, to which he contributed many essays, and which he made a medium for agitating a variety of local reforms. In 1732, he began to issue his famous Poor Richard's Almanac, for the enrichment of which he borrowed or composed those pithy utterances of worldly wisdom which are the basis of a large part of his popular reputation. In 1758, the year in which he ceases writing for the Almanac, he printed in it Father Abraham's Sermon, now regarded as the most famous piece of literature produced in colonial America. Meantime, Franklin was concerning himself more and more with public affairs. He set forth a scheme for an academy, which was taken up later and finally developed into the University of Pennsylvania. And he founded an American Philosophical Society for the purpose of enabling scientific men to communicate their discoveries to one another. He himself had already begun his electrical researches, which, with other scientific inquiries, he called on in the intervals of money-making and politics to the end of his life. In 1748, he sold his business in order to get leisure for study, having now acquired comparative wealth. And in a few years he had made discoveries that gave him a reputation with the learned throughout Europe. In politics he proved very able, both as an administrator and as a controversialist. His most notable service in home politics was his reform of the postal system. But his fame as a statesman rests chiefly on his services in connection with the relations of the colonies with Great Britain and later with France. In 1757 he was sent to England to protest against the influence of the Penns in the government of the colony, and for 5 years he remained there, striving to enlighten the people and the ministry of England as to colonial affairs. On his return to America, he played an honorable part in the Paxton Affair, through which he lost his seat in the Assembly. But in 1764 he was again dispatched to England as an agent for the colony, this time to petition the king to resume the government from the hands of the proprietors. In London he actively opposed the proposed Stamp Act, but lost the credit for this and much of his popularity through his securing for a friend the office of stamp agent in America. Even his effective work in helping to obtain the repeal of that act left him still suspect. But he continued his efforts to present the case for the colonies as the troubles thickened toward the crisis of the Revolution. In 1767 he crossed to France, where he was received with honor, but before his return home in 1775 he lost his position as postmaster through his share in divulging to Massachusetts the famous letter of Hutchinson and Oliver. On his arrival in Philadelphia, he was chosen a member of the Continental Congress, and in 1777 he was dispatched to France as commissioner for the United States. Here he remained till 1785, the favorite of French society, and with such success did he conduct the affairs of his country that when he finally returned, he received a place only second to that of Washington as the champion of American independence. He died on April 17, 1790. The first 5 chapters of the autobiography were composed in England in 1771, continued in 1784-85, and again in 1788, at which date he brought it down to 1757. After a most extraordinary series of adventures, the original form of the manuscript was finally printed by Mr. John Bigelow, and is here reproduced in recognition of its value as a picture of one of the most notable personalities of colonial time and of its acknowledged rank as one of the great autobiographies of the world. Dear son, I have ever had pleasure in obtaining any little antidotes of my ancestors. You may remember the inquiries I made among the remains of my relations when you were with me in England, and the journey I undertook for that purpose. Imagining it may be equally agreeable to you to know the circumstances of my life, many of which you are yet unacquainted with, and expecting the enjoyment of a week's uninterrupted leisure in my present country retirement, I sit down to write them for you. To which I have besides some other inducements. Having emerged from the poverty and obscurity in which I was born and bred, to a state of affluence and some degree of reputation in the world, and having gone so far through life with a considerable share of felicity, the conducing means I made use of, which with the blessings of God so well succeeded, my posterity may like to know, as they may find some of them suitable to their own situations, and therefore fit to be imitated. That felicity, when I reflect on it, has induced me sometimes to say that were it offered to my choice, I should have no objection to a repetition of the same life from its beginning, only asking the advantages authors have in a second edition to correct some faults of the first. So I might, besides correcting the faults, change some sinister accidents and events of it for others more favorable. But though this were denied, I should still accept the offer. Since such a repetition is not to be expected, the next thing most like living one's life over again seems to be a recollection of that life, and to make that recollection as durable as possible by putting it down in writing. Hereby, too, I shall indulge the inclination, so natural in old men, to be talking of themselves and their own past actions. And I shall indulge it without being tiresome to others, who through respect to age might conceive themselves obliged to give me a hearing, since this may be read or not as anyone pleases. And lastly, I may as well confess it, since my denial of it will be believed by nobody, perhaps I shall a good deal gratify my own vanity. Indeed, I scarce ever heard or saw the introductory words, without vanity I may say, but some vain thing immediately followed. Most people dislike vanity in others, whatever share they have of it in themselves. But I give it fair quarter wherever I meet with it, being persuaded that it is often productive of good to the possessor and to the others that are within his sphere of action. And therefore, in many cases, it would not be altogether absurd if a man were to thank God for his vanity among the other comforts of life. And now I speak of thanking God. I desire with all humility to acknowledge that I owe the mentioned happiness of my past life to his kind providence, which led me to the means I use and gave them success. My belief of this induces me to hope, though I must not presume, that the same goodness will still be exercised toward me in continuing that happiness, or enabling me to bear a fatal reverse, which I may experience as others have done, the complexion of my future fortune being known to him only, in whose power it is to bless us, even in our afflictions. The notes one of my uncles, who had the same kind of curiosity in collecting family antidotes, once put into my hands, furnished me with several particulars relating to our ancestors. From these notes I learned that the family had lived in the same village, Ecton, in Northamptonshire, for 300 years, and how much longer he knew not, on a freehold of about 30 acres, aided by the Smith's business, which had continued in the family till his time, the eldest son being always bred to that business, a custom which he and my father followed as to their eldest son. When I searched the registers at Ecton, I found an account of their births, marriages, and burials from the year 1555 only, there being no registers kept in that parish at any time preceding. By that register I perceived that I was the youngest son of the youngest son for 5 generations back. My grandfather Thomas, who was born in 1598, lived at Ecton till he grew too old to follow business longer, when he went to live with his son John, a dyer at Banbury in Oxfordshire, with whom my father served an apprenticeship. There my grandfather died and lies buried. We saw his gravestone in 1758. His eldest son Thomas lived in the house at Ecton, and left it with the land to his only child, a daughter, who with her husband, one Fisher of Wellingborough, sold it to Mr. Isted, now lord of the manor there. My grandfather had four sons that grew up, vis-a-vis Thomas, John, Benjamin, and Josiah. I will give you what account I can of them at this distance from my papers, and if they are not lost in my absence, you will among them find many more particulars. Thomas was bred a smith under his father, but being ingenious and encouraged in learning, as all my brothers were by an Esquire Palmer, then the principal gentleman in that parish, he qualified himself for the business of scrivener, became a considerable man in the county, was a chief mover of all public-spirited undertakings for the county or town of Northampton and his own village, of which many instances were related of him, and much taken notice of and patronized by the then Lord Halifax. He died in 1702, January 6th, old style, just 4 years to a day before I was born. The account we received of his life and character from some old people at Ecton, I remember struck you as something extraordinary from its similarity to what you knew of mine. Had he died on the same day 4 years later, you said, one might have supposed a transmigration. John was bred a dyer, I believe of Woolens. Benjamin was bred a silk dyer, serving an apprenticeship at London. He was an ingenious man. I remember him well, for when I was a boy he came over to my father in Boston and lived in the house with us some years. He lived to a great age. His grandson, Samuel Franklin, now lives in Boston. He left behind him two quarto volumes of his own poetry, consisting of little occasional pieces addressed to his friends and relations. He had formed a shorthand of his own, which he taught me, but never practicing it, I have now forgotten it. I was named after this uncle, there being a particular affection between him and my father. He was very pious, a great attender of sermons of the best preachers, which he took down in his shorthand and had with him many volumes of them. He was also much of a politician, too much perhaps for his station. There fell lately into my hands in London a collection he had made of all the principal pamphlets relating to public affairs from 1641 to 1717. Many of the volumes are wanting, as appears by the numbering, but there still remain 8 volumes in folio, and 24 in quarto and in octavo. A dealer in old books met with them, and knowing me by my sometimes buying of him, he brought them to me. It seems my uncle must have left them here when he went to America, which was about 50 years since. There are many of his notes in the margin. This obscure family of ours was early in the Reformation, and continued Protestants through the reign of Queen Mary, when they were sometimes in danger of trouble on account of their zeal against popery. They had got an English Bible, and to conceal and secure it, it was fastened open with tapes under and within the cover of a joint stool. When my great-great-grandfather read it to his family, he turned up the joint stool upon his knees, turning over the leaves then under the tapes. One of the children stood at the door to give notice if he saw the proprietor coming, who was an officer of the spiritual court. In that case the stool was turned down again upon its feet, when the Bible remained concealed under it as before. This anecdote I had from my Uncle Benjamin. The family continued all of the Church of England till about the end of Charles II's reign, when some of the ministers that had been ousted for nonconformity, holding conventicles in Northamptonshire, Benjamin and Josiah adhered to them, and so continued all their lives. The rest of the family remained with the Episcopal Church. Josiah, my father, married young, and carried his wife with 3 children into New England about 1682. The conventicles having been forbidden by law, and frequently disturbed, induced some considerable men of his acquaintance to remove to that country, and he was prevailed with to accompany them thither, where they expected to enjoy their mode of religion with freedom. By the same wife he had 4 children more born there, and by a second wife 10 more, in all 17, of which I remember 13 sitting at one time at his table, who all grew up to be men and women and married. I was the youngest son, and the youngest child but 2, and was born in Boston, New England. My mother, the second wife, was Abiah Folger, daughter of Peter Folger, one of the first settlers of New England, of whom honorable mention is made by Cotton Mather in his church history of that country, entitled Magnalia Christi Americana, as a godly learned Englishman, if I remember the words rightly. I have heard that he wrote sundry small occasional pieces, but only one of them was printed, which I saw now many years since. It was written in 1675, in the homespun verse of that time and people, and addressed to those then concerned in the government there. It was in favor of liberty of conscience, and in behalf of the Anabaptists, Quakers, and other sectaries that had been under persecution, ascribing the Indian Wars and other distresses that had befallen the country to that persecution, as so many judgments of God to punish so heinous an offense, and exhorting a repeal of those uncharitable laws. The whole appeared to me as written with a good deal of decent plainness and manly freedom. The 6 concluding lines I remember, though I have forgotten the 2 first of the stanza. But the purport of them was that his censures proceeded from goodwill, and therefore he would be known to be the author. "Because to be a libeler," says he, "I hate it with all my heart. From Sherburne town where now I dwell, my name I do put here. Without offense, your real friend, it is Peter Folger." My elder brothers were all put apprentices to different trades. I was put to the grammar school at 8 years of age, my father intending to devote me, as the tithe of his sons, to the service of the church. My early readiness in learning to read, which must have been very early, as I do not remember when I could not read, and the opinion of all his friends that I should certainly make a good scholar, encouraged him in this purpose of his. My Uncle Benjamin, too, approved of it, and proposed to give me all his shorthand volume of sermons, I suppose as a stock to set up with, if I would learn his character. I continued, however, at the grammar school not quite a year, though in that time I had risen gradually from the middle of the class of that year to be the head of it, and father was removed into the next class above it, in order to go with that into the 3rd at the end of the year. But my father, in the meantime, from a view of the expense of a college education, which having so large a family he could not well afford, and the mean living many so educated were afterwards able to obtain, reasons that he gave to his friends in my hearing, altered his first intention, took me from the grammar school, and sent me to a school for writing and arithmetic, kept by a then-famous man, Mr. George Brownwell, very successful in his profession generally, and that by mild and encouraging methods. Under him I acquired fair writing pretty soon, but I failed in the arithmetic and made no progress in it. At 10 years old I was taken home to assist my father in his business, which was that of a tallow chandler and soap boiler, a business he was not bred to, but had assumed on his arrival in New England, and on finding his dying trade would not maintain his family, being in little request. Accordingly, I was employed in cutting wick for the candles, filling the dipping mold and the molds for cask candles, attending the shop, going of errands, etc. I disliked the trade, and had a strong inclination for the sea, but my father declared against it. However, living near the water, I was much in it and about it, learnt early to swim well and to manage boats, and when in a boat or canoe with other boys, I was commonly allowed to govern, especially in any case of difficulty. And upon other occasions I was generally a leader among the boys, and sometimes led them into scrapes, of which I will mention one instance, as it shows an early projecting public spirit, though not then justly conducted. There was a salt marsh that bounded part of the mill pond, on the edge of which, at high water, we used to stand to fish for minnows. By much trampling we had made it a mere quagmire. My proposal was to build a wharf there, fit for us to stand upon, and I showed my comrades a large heap of stones, which were intended for a new house near the marsh, and which would very well suit our purpose. Accordingly, in the evening, when the workmen were gone, I assembled a number of my playfellows, and working with them diligently, like so many emets, sometimes two or three to a stone, we brought them all away and built our little wharf. The next morning the workmen were surprised at missing the stones, which were found in our wharf. Inquiry was made after the removers, we were discovered and complained of, and several of us were corrected by our fathers. And though I pleaded the usefulness of the work, mine convinced me that nothing was useful which was not honest. I think you may like to know something of his person and character. He had an excellent constitution of body, was of middle stature, but well set, and very strong. He was ingenious, could draw prettily, was skilled a little in music, and had a clear, pleasing voice. So that when he played psalm tunes on his violin, and sung withal, as he sometimes did in an evening after the business of the day was over, it was extremely agreeable to hear. He had a mechanical genius too, and on occasion was very handy in the use of other tradesmen's tools. But his great excellence lay in a sound understanding and solid judgment in prudential matters, both in private and public affairs. In the latter, indeed, he was never employed. The numerous family he had to educate and the straitness of his circumstances kept him close to his trade. But I remember well his being frequently visited by leading people who consulted him for his opinion in the affairs of the town or of the church he belonged to, and showed a good deal of respect for his judgment and advice. He was also much consulted by private persons about their affairs when any difficulty occurred, and frequently chosen an arbitrator between contending parties. At his table he liked to have, as often as he could, some sensible friend or neighbor to converse with, and always took care to start some ingenious or useful topic for discourse, which might tend to improve the minds of his children. By this means he turned our attention to what was good, just, and prudent in the conduct of life, and little or no notice was ever taken of what related to the victuals on the table, whether it was well or ill dressed, in or out of season, of good or bad flavor, preferable or inferior to this or that other thing of the kind, so that I was brought up in such a perfect inattention to those matters as to be quite indifferent what kind of food was set before me, and so unobservant of it that to this day, if I am asked, I can scarce tell a few hours after dinner what I dined upon. This has been a convenience to me in traveling, where my companions have been sometimes very unhappy for want of suitable gratification of their more delicate, because better instructed, tastes and appetites. My mother had likewise an excellent constitution. She suckled all 10 of her children. I never knew either my father or mother to have any sickness but that of which they died, he at 89 and she at 85 years of age. They lie buried together at Boston, where I some years since placed a marble over their grave with this inscription: Josiah Franklin and Abiah his wife lie here interred. They lived lovingly together in wedlock 55 years. Without an estate or any gainful employment, by constant labor and industry, with God's blessing, they maintained a large family comfortably, and brought up 13 children and 7 grandchildren reputably. From this instance, reader, be encouraged to diligence in thy calling, and distrust not Providence. He was a pious and prudent man, she a discreet and virtuous woman. Their youngest son, in filial regard to their memory, places this stone. J.F., born 1655, died 1744, age 89. A.F., born 1667, died 1752, age 85.
更多免费英语学习资源，请访问优学英语网。优学英语网，优秀的英语学习网站。 免费咨询 QQ 973-11-955